Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, our appeal presents two separate procedural due process issues. The first, what might be called the procedures used issue, and the second being the bias issue. The procedures used issues, Your Honor, we believe proceeds from an undisputed set of facts, meaning what happened when between the parties in terms of getting to that hearing and what process was offered and what we think is required, and I'd just like to maybe briefly review that with the Court. Your Honor, we believe that the cases indicate that from Loudermill and Gilbert on down, that the post-termination, minimal due process is appropriate when there's adequate post-deprivation due process. It's our view of the cases, Your Honor, that in the employment context, the post-termination process needs to be provided at the administrative stage before there has been a final deprivation, because there's a property interest involved and a present entitlement. Most of the cases, Your Honor, where this Court has dealt with the availability of post-deprivation process in the employment context come up where you have a civil service commission which reviews the decision of the of termination, where you've got a fire and police commission, a merit board, or under the Court's most recent opinions, grievance and arbitration. All of that, Your Honors, is done where you have an administrative mechanism before the employer is done with you. You have more than that initial check. And I think the basis for our believing that, Your Honor, goes all the way back to Loudermill, where the Supreme Court stated that initial check of notice, summary of evidence, and an opportunity to be heard without the right of confrontation and cross-examination was predicated on the fact that Mr. Loudermill had the Ohio Civil Service Personnel Board hearing available, which is the functional equivalent of our Civil Service Commission. Dr. Baird, unlike, I know the Court's had a lot of, in district court days, has had a lot of Chicago school board cases. In those cases, dealing with Chicago school teachers, we have a statutory mechanism where school board brings the charges and there's a hearing in front of an administrative hearing officer. So even in that context, there is an administrative process before the employer has completed the deprivation. The conclusion that we reached, Your Honor, based on that, there was that preceding series of correspondence, what were we going to receive, was that the hearing would have been hollow. We were told, Your Honor, at the front end, and to a certain extent, of course, it's a judgmental decision. We were told at the front end, school board wasn't going to bring any witnesses. So the people who lodged these complaints about us, we didn't know who they are. If we asked to have some teachers come in or some employees come in, school board says, well, we're not going to assist you in that. We're not going to say to Mrs. Jones, to Mrs. Smith, please be at the school board meeting on Wednesday night. We knew that the school board members were going to say, well, we will allow board member Cleary to speak to some of the evaluations, and you may only inquire of her as to that matter. So if, for example, we raise this issue about Mrs. Gates and the residency and being the election authority. Under the rules prescribed for us, had Mrs. Gates not talked about the residency issue, we wouldn't have been able to inquire of her as to that issue. Your Honor, we took the school district lawyers at their word. The school district did. In our view of the cases, Your Honor, if the hearing is presumed to be fair, but I think the reading of the cases is if we know at the front end, if we know at the outset that it's going to be a kangaroo court, there is no waiver. Yes, Your Honor, the cases that we cited in the brief indicated that. I'd be happy to retrieve the brief and I'll mention it to you on rebuttal, but the cases say... Well, Your Honor, it was more than showing up. The sequence was the evaluation came and said these were the charges. I'm fully aware of what the charges were. I asked for... you know, what we consider to be what due process entitled. Dear school board attorney, please provide me some documents and please let me know who these people are. School board attorney writes back, thank you for your letter, Mr. Murphy. We have a different view of what the law requires. And they gave me the menu. They gave me the rules of engagement beforehand. Had it been silent and had I not known, I think, Your Honors, because of the presumption of the fairness of procedures, had I not known at the outset what the rules of engagement were going to be, I would have had a waiver. Some of the charges, yes, he could, Your Honor, but insofar as giving his side of the story, but he was told that he would not be able to confront or cross-examine. That is correct, Your Honor. As to certain of the matters, namely, most notably, the residency, Mr. Baird could have said, I've been living at the bread and breakfast. But what we couldn't have done is ask Mrs. Gates any questions, I believe that the bulk of the evaluation really relates to what people told the school board. But so I agree with Your Honor as to a couple of the, you know, I might call bright line things. You didn't live in the school district, that Mr. Baird could have said his side of the story. But keeping in mind, this is a, you know, school board where the board members go to a board meeting once a month. They pay the bills, act on policy. Where the bulk of many of these allegations and the charges relate to, it's been reported to us. Teachers say that you have the wrong style. You're having, you know, who? And who is this? We'd like to be able to inquire of them as to why they said this and if they exist. If they exist. And kind of the frustrating thing for me in this, we've got a situation now in Illinois, I know it's the Illinois Appellate Court and not, you know, binding on this court, where a school student facing a one-year expulsion under, you know, our state appellate court's view of what procedural process requires that there be confrontation by the accusers. Now that's an uncomfortable thing to have to ask employers or a school district to do. If that 17-year-old is accused of selling drugs or accused of threatening somebody, tell the courts that the property interest for a one-year or two-year expulsion is so strong, the private interest under the Matthews test is so strong, that there needs to be confrontation and cross-examination. That's the Colquitt case. I would submit to the court that when you're a school superintendent, you've worked 25 years to get that superintendent's job. You've got your 3-year contract, and you're going to be fired. You're going to be fired your first year. A professional knockout punch. That you should have, he should have at least the same procedural due process rights that a student facing loss of education for a year or two should have. And, Your Honor, in terms of the Matthews case, I'm really in the wrong building to talk about economics and cost-benefit, but it's cheaper. It's cheaper to do it this way. It's cheaper on using the private interest. The additional costs to the school district are minimal. Minimal. That's it.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, with my co-counsel, Rob Swain, we represent the appellees in this case. I think, Your Honor, quite simply, as appellant's counsel said, there are two legal issues in this case. And in our judgment, and we believe it's clearly supported, that the district court in both cases correctly applied settled law on both issues and properly ruled for the appellees on each of them, starting first with the pre-termination procedures. Going all the way back to the seminal case of Loudermill is very clear that prior to termination, all that is required is notice and an opportunity to be heard. No, Your Honor, I think it's quite different, because in the Ryan case, the plaintiff actually presented his side of the story and gave the decision maker some response to the concerns. To the very, very contrary in this case, Dr. Baird, on not one but two occasions, both when he was offered an evaluation conference to discuss the evaluation before we moved to the pre-termination hearing stage, and then again at the pre-termination hearing stage, simply turned his back and walked away from his employer and said, I don't care that you have these concerns. I don't care that you think I've not done the job that you are instructed by law is your fundamental responsibility, which is to oversee me in running your school district, the school district that the voters of this community have entrusted to your care. I will not even bother to respond to your concerns that I am spending school district money unwisely, that I'm not showing up for my job when I should, that in fact I failed to file a grant application which lost you your school nurse for next year. I don't even have to explain to you why those things happened. Yeah, I think that there are circumstances, depending on the nature of the deprivation. I think, for example, there has been suggestion in some of the cases that a tenured employee defending his tenure rights, those are separate and apart from contract. And what you have there is a state statutory entitlement. Well, Your Honor, I think in this case, Your Honor, I think just to respond on a couple of issues. First of all, in this case, in fact, Dr. Baird did not seek to reclaim his job. His complaint only asks for money damages. He's never sought anything else. He's never sought to be reinstated into the position or to fulfill the rest of the term of his contract, which I think makes it somewhat different from the other present entitlement cases, which tend to request as part of the relief a return to the employment. No, Your Honor, I think still in this case it would be, because I think, Your Honor, it's important to distinguish in the present entitlement cases to those which exist solely under an individual employment contract and those which exist as part of a larger structure such as tenure, which create a panoply of state rights which have somewhat different impacts. And with regard to the timeliness of relief, in Loudermill itself, I think, contrary to what counsel for the appellant suggested, Loudermill's remedies, his post-termination remedies, were just that. They were post-termination. The employer was through with him. He went to a separate place to seek relief. That's true in virtually all of these cases. The same is true with arbitration. The employer has finally and completely terminated the employee before they can move on, and indeed that's a precondition to moving into the administrative arena. The Loudermill administrative proceeding took over 9 months, according to the Supreme Court. There's no indication that Joe Davies County couldn't have handled a breach of contract case in a similar amount of time. So, in fact, there was no evidence before the district court that, in fact, it is any more time-consuming for this plaintiff to have proceeded in contract. Your Honor, I don't think that in the language of Loudermill or in any of the other cases, the courts have said that present entitlement cases can't use judicial. Well, the Supreme Court, I think, in Loudermill and in subsequent cases, refers to administrative and judicial remedies. The cases that have come before the court have been cases in which administrative remedies were offered as post-termination remedies, but the court has never held that a judicial remedy is insufficient, and clearly the amount of process provided in a judicial proceeding far exceeds that in an administrative proceeding. In arbitration, for example, which counsel apparently concedes is appropriate, there's no discovery, there's no jury, there's no adequate judicial review. All of those things are in place in a contract action that is much more protective of the plaintiff's rights than an arbitrator appointed from a panel. I believe in our brief we cite, and the only post-Lujan case that we could find that referred to it, there's a case actually in the district courts in Florida in which the court there held that a post-transfer judicial remedy was adequate with no pre-termination procedures at all. And as I've said, in the prior cases, we have found no case in which any court has held that a post-termination judicial remedy is insufficient to provide due process. I believe it was a transfer, Your Honor. I believe in terms of the severity of the outcome, but I think in terms of whether or not there was the issue there was whether or not procedural due process was implicated. I believe the court found it was, but there was adequate post-deprivation procedure, and the court in Florida found that there was in fact a deprivation issue presented, and that's why it looked at the issue of post-deprivation remedies. Your Honor, if I may, I believe that the record indicates that, in fact, Judge Reinhart gave it very careful consideration, and indeed, after the briefs were submitted, both sides were asked to submit supplemental briefs specifically on the Matthews factors, as Judge Reinhart wanted fuller briefing on that issue so he could consider it more fully. I believe in his opinion, which is notable for its brevity and the smallness of its type, as many of his are, I believe he tried to address that in a somewhat terse fashion. But I believe that although the language may have been cursory, I believe that the record reflects, given the fact that both sides had briefed fully the issue of procedural due process, as both sides had motions for summary judgment on file on that issue. We had also filed a motion to dismiss on the same issue, and that had been fully briefed. And we had then been asked to submit supplemental briefs specifically on the Matthews factors, that in fact, Judge Reinhart, I believe, gave it full consideration. He just described his reasoning briefly. Thank you very much.
Very three quick points, Judge Cuddy. The case I was referring to was Suckle, S-U-C-K-L-E, which holds that if at the beginning of the process, if the offeree, meaning the employee, knows that the procedures are going to be insufficient, versus Madison General Hospital, 499, Fed Second, 1364, and that in turn cites to a case called Miller versus School Board. Your Honor asked about case authority from other jurisdictions. They've got a district court case. We have the Tenth Circuit case in McClure, which is exactly on point. School principal, one-year contract, so the entitlement is 1 year. Tenth Circuit holds affidavits aren't enough. It's so important. The Matthews balance tips to the employee, and cross-examination is required. So we'd ask the court to consider the sister circuit. There's no difference on a due process end between a tenured employee, that's a state law that creates the property interest, versus a multi-year contract. That's a mutual contract. Your Honor, in response to your question, the entitlement is the same. So what's fair? And, Your Honor, in concluding, to answer your question about, I think your question was, if we've got this situation here where there's only one hearing, the exception is going to swallow the rule. And that's exactly what this court said in Swank, where it said a first hearing need not provide a full set of procedural safeguards if there is a chance for second hearing before termination. Second chance for hearing before termination. So if there's no second chance for hearing before termination, simple arithmetic in our view, you've got to give somebody with this high of a private interest a fair hearing, which gives him the right. No, Your Honor, it was doing this for 28 years, I know even in Joe Davies County, with 2 years left on the contract, we live in a world where 30 to 60 days is a blink of an eye. And the reality is that the relationship was severed. And he wanted to benefit his bargain. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you very much.